Recording in progress.
Okay, back on the Spring Hill preliminary plat application and SEPA appeal. We're still in the applicant's presentation of their project. I believe they had another witness they wanted to bring up for some more commentary. So, Mr. Gore, who was that? I don't.
It's our project engineer, David Nason.
David Nason, okay. Oh, there he is. Okay. And Mr. Nason, I don't think I got to the point of swearing you in yet, so let me do that once we get you up. Do you swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay. And how do you spell your last name for the transcript?
It's Nason, N as in November, A-S-O-N.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
My comments today are to respond to the staff stormwater comments. My name is David Nason. I'm with AHBL. I'm a professional licensed civil engineer. I authored the stormwater plan and drainage report. The preliminary storm plan was submitted and revised, addressing the first round of county comments that we received in March 2024. The storm plan was revised to meet the flow control requirements and adjusted also primarily to maintain the wetland hydrology. The comments included, the comments received from the county did include the comment on the groundwater monitoring plan, which was in the staff comments as not being addressed. Since we received that comment in March, the monitoring requirement requires monitoring to happen in the wet season, which is November through March. Since at the time of the comments, since that season had passed, we contacted the county reviewer and were informed that that requirement could be a condition of the plat to be addressed with the SDAP permits. As a matter of process, prior to the actual construction of anything, an SDA permit is required, and those SDA permit application documents would include a final drainage plan and also drainage calculations, which would address any county final comments. Requirements. Should the monitoring result in shallow groundwater, the final plan can be adjusted to use bioretention facilities and more permeable paving throughout the site if additional separation is required. Our geotechnical engineer's assessment, which was included with the drainage plan report, aligned with the county's comment that the soils are limited in capacity for infiltration. However, that was recognized in the infiltration rates that were used to design the storm system. Just for record, we used the 0.3 inches per hour infiltration rate, which is very, very small. So based on the comments that I described here, we feel that our drainage report shows that the plan is feasible and any conditions or additional needs for the county can be addressed in the SDAP permitting process.
Thank you, Mr. Nason. Okay, Mr. Gordy, anybody else?
Yes, Mr. Examiner. I'll let Mr. Smith take it.
Okay.
Well, I put Mr. Nason up because Hayes had to recover his voice, so I'm going to turn it right back over. We have some misunderstanding about the application of the fire code in regard to the separation of the fire accesses and the math and measurements that are included. So, Mr. Gorey.
Okay. I'm locating the section of the staff report. Anyway, this pertains to the portion where they're talking about the fire access, and they cite the International Fire Code, Here it is. Okay, so it's page 34 of 39 of the staff report. They cite the International Fire Code, Chapter 5, Section 503.1.2, which is adopted by Kitsap County Code Title 14, and the Kitsap County Road Standards 2020, Chapter 4. What they say here in the staff report is that a second access is required when there are more than 150 dwellings. Well, that's not what the cited authority says. If you go to International Fire Code Section 503.1.2, I will read it into the record. It just says the fire code official is authorized to acquire more than one fire apparatus access road based on the potential for impairment of a single road by vehicle congestion, condition of terrain, climatic conditions, or other factors that could limit access. That's the sum total of that section of the fire code. And that's just easily Googleable. And then the Kitsap County Road Standards 2020 Chapter 4, this is how it reads in terms of the requirement. A minimum of two access points separated by no less than half the diagonal of the property or area served shall be required for developments that generate more than 1,000 ADT, annual daily trips, unless other mitigating measures are approved by the county fire marshal. Okay, so first of all, there's no mention, as there is in the staff report here, of the number of units. That is not the metric. It says here a second access is required when there are more than 150 dwellings. That's not what the authority provides. It's ADTs, and if you have more than 1,000, then you have to have two access points. Per our traffic impact analysis, which is Exhibit F43, page 19 is the summary. It estimates 916 ADTs. The staff report at page 31 acknowledges that, and I don't think there's any dispute. They don't challenge those findings. Thus, two emergency access points are not required. So that should be the end of it. It's an issue of ADTs. We're under 1,000. That's the end of it. Nonetheless, okay, David wants me to explain what ADT, average daily trips. Yeah, we're talking car trips in and out of the project. Yeah, various times a day, but the average daily trips is 916 for this project. And that's a function of the affordability and the size of the units, all those technical metrics. But again, it's in the record. It's Exhibit F43 is the traffic impact analysis for 916 ADTs. So if we could get the site plan up, Liliana, you could please do that. So there it is. So though it's two access points are not required, we actually do have two, and I'm going to get there. We have two gated fire accesses in addition to our regular primary access. They're both on Linvog. One's at the southeast corner, the very southeast corner. One's up at the northeast corner. And then the diagonal you can see is drawn on the site plan. It might need to blow it up a little bit, but it's goes from the southeast corner all the way over to the furthest west townhome. And it says 521, or no, it says, could you blow it up? I can't read it. Yeah, it says, it's the line that crosses right there. You can see it from the southeast townhome all the way over to the most westerly townhome. You could blow up so we could see the numbers. I believe it says 1,025 feet. Right there. Yeah, there you go. So that diagonal, it's the area served, right? The townhomes, the area where fire trucks would actually need to apply water if there's a fire. It's 1,025 feet, the diagonal, and so half of that is 512. And then if you kind of pan back out again or pull back, you can see that Gavin, our surveyor, has marked the distance on the right-hand side on Linvog between the two gated fire access points, the southeast corner, northeast corner. It's more than that 512 feet. So even though it's not required to have the two fire accesses, we have them separated by more than one half of the diagonal of the area served. And in addition, we have our primary entrance. So we actually have three places where fire trucks could enter if need be. So that's that. And again, there was discussion about this before. I actually, I'd like to point out March 5th, 2024 email from Mr. Gurney to us, Exhibit B19. We don't have to call it up, but it's in the record. But one of the things stated in the email, it's a summary of a meeting we've had with staff. It says, quote, the fire marshal will consider one half of the diagonal of the area served if no other development can be made on the remaining open space if all the buildings are sprinklered, end quote. So in the project, all the buildings are sprinklered, and we have that conservation easement prohibiting development on anything outside of the building footprint. So I thought we had the issue resolved, but again, we were surprised. We see this in the staff report, another way in which to thwart the project. So that was disappointing to see that. And that's all I have on that.
That concludes.
Anything else from the office? Oh, sorry.
Oh, it doesn't conclude.
Yeah, so we have one of our two wetland specialists here, Robin Myers. She's right behind us, and she would like to speak to a couple of points regarding the plat and PBD. And she will also be a witness during the SEPA appeal later.
Okay.
Good morning.
All right, Ms. Myers, let me swear again. Just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, and is it M-E-Y-E-R-S, is that correct?
It's Robin Myers, R-O-B-B-Y-N-M-Y-E-R-S.
Okay, great, go ahead.
I'm with BGE. I represent the plat as a supplemental biologist to work through all the environmental issues. And I just want to touch base on some points that I heard in the staff report by Mr. Gurney. One was in regard to the Kitsap County checklist for avoidance and minimization. Mr. Gurney pointed to one of the options, or it was one of the tasks that you went through the checklist, and where it said use steeper slopes or walls to avoid. And he pointed or referenced to the fact to a point in the western part of the property saying maybe move the development over to steeper slopes, which are geohazard areas. The intention of that statement in avoidance and minimization is not to move a development into another geohazard. It is meant to put like a 2-to-1 slope next to a wetland fill, or rather put a wall next to the wetland fill. Secondly, he talked about an example of where I believe the reference was the variance was waived. I don't remember the language he used, but he didn't. The project didn't have to go through this variance because they got an Army Corps permit, and that was in regarding the Silverdale YMCA. And it's my understanding that the YMCA, it's a not-for-profit organization, and they had some federal grants, which meant that there was a federal nexus, and so they were under NEPA, and NEPA kind of swallows SEPA, so I don't know that, although they had to comply with Kitsap County codes, federal nexus is their requirements are generally a lot stronger and have a lot more grit to them. So I'm going to imagine that Kitsap County just kind of punted those requirements along with that project. Lastly, with all due respect to the headwaters of this wetland being the headwaters to Carpenter Creek and that being a very sensitive watershed, I love that Kitsap County is actually notices that and takes heart to that. But I do want to make the point that at the end of this project, with our mitigated measures, we will actually have more wetland, headwater wetland, than what's there now, because we're doing wetland creation. So in fact, we're creating 1.5 to 1 for the impacts that we're having. So we kind of walk away with more than 7,000 more square feet of wetland in the end. And that would be it.
Okay, a couple questions for you. I mean, about how many different cities and counties have you worked with in doing wetland evaluations?
Oh, over 50, easy.
Okay, and do any of those allow applicants to encroach into buffers and develop simply by applying the wetland mitigation sequence, as opposed to, you know, having to go through a variance or a reasonable use process or one of the code exemptions?
Well, both wetland and buffers impacts have to go through mitigation sequencing, but But the process in which you get to an end result for a buffer is typically a variance, because you always have a buffer on a wetland, but it's not always the standard. You ask for a variance because it's not, it varies from what the standard is. When you have a wetland and you're asking to have an impact to a wetland, you get rid of the wetland. So it's not a variance, but when you mitigate for that, you have more. You can't have you can't hit a wetland and not have no net loss or have more wetlands. It's just the way that the mitigation standards.
Setting aside, I guess I'm just, you know, because I was going to question Mr. Gorey about this, because I've worked with about 40 to 50 jurisdictions as well, and I've never seen a single jurisdiction allow a developer to encroach in a buffer simply because they're using mitigation sequencing. They have to use the variance, reasonable use, or qualify under one of the exceptions. So I'm just trying to find out from you, with comparable experience, have you ever seen a local jurisdiction allow that? And not where we're removing a buffer, maybe under, you know, federal Army Corps law, but under their ordinance. Have you seen a jurisdiction allow a developer to build something within a buffer simply because they're applying the wet mitigation sequencing?
Yes. If you're talking about the buffer next to the wetland that we're impacting, that...
No, I'm talking about, again, just... I'm just wondering if any city or county has ever interpreted their code to allow somebody with an existing wetland to develop within the buffer just because they're using mitigation sequencing and not via an exception. They didn't apply for an exception. They don't qualify for it. They're not applying via variance or reasonable use. That developers just claiming, well, we're following mitigation sequencing requirements, and therefore we are allowed to build within this wetland buffer. I mean, I just, like I say, I've just never seen a jurisdiction do that. And I'm just curious if your experience is similar to mine in working with so many jurisdictions.
I guess I'm just not, it's not clear what you're asking. You're asking me, can you build in a buffer without having a variance?
Exactly. Yeah, variance or reasonable use or qualifying for an exception. Because one of the arguments I see Mr. Gorey making is, and also a judge agrees with them in Kitsap County, that you don't need to apply for a variance or a critical areas reasonable use exception. As well, if you meet mitigation sequencing, you go through that process and you show that you've complied with that, you're fine. You can do anything you want within that wetland buffer. And that's, you know, I mean, the whole idea of eliminating the buffer wetland entirely could be a completely distinguishable, you know, action. But I'm just kind of curious about the argument that Mr. Gorey's made, at least as I understand it, that just solely based on mitigation sequencing, you can do anything you want within a wetland buffer as long as you meet those mitigation sequencing requirements.
Well, no. Once you hit a wetland, the buffers aren't even there, because it doesn't matter where the buffer, if you hit the buffer or not, because you mitigate for that buffer. So that's part of the sequencing. Why would you need to have another process to mitigate for a buffer and a process to mitigate for a wetland? They're the same thing.
If you have a 200-foot buffer and a developer wants to say, put a an accessory dwelling unit within that 200-foot buffer, the argument I hear Mr. Gorey saying is, as long as you do mitigation sequencing, you can do it. You don't need to apply for a variance. You don't need to apply for reasonable use. You don't need to qualify for any exception. If you just comply with mitigation sequencing, you can build anything you want in that 200-foot buffer.
I don't think
that's
the
argument I'm having trouble with.
Pardon me. That's not what he's arguing. That's not what our project is. You can build in a buffer, and you would need a variance, but that's not what our project is. We're not building in a buffer. We have wetland impacts, and we're mitigating for all impacts, including the buffers that are against that wetland.
If you look at
19, where you get to wetland mitigation, 19200, whatever, it says wetland and buffer for mitigation sequencing. So if you want to reduce a buffer, you get a variance. But if you're going to hit a buffer and a wetland, you go to mitigation sequencing. Well, you go to full mitigation.
Mr. Examiner, we're going to cover this in detail in the CEPA appeal, but if I may, what Robin is saying is we're not building setbacks or buffers. If you look at the mitigation plan and the impact overview, we have a solid 50-foot buffer in between all wetlands and our development. Solid 50-foot, right? Some of it's indirect impact with wetlands serving as buffer, which is perfectly permissible. That's tried and true method, but we have a solid 50-foot buffer between the wetland and our project. No incursion, no development, no nothing. Okay, so we are not impacting buffers. Okay, Robin and Joanne say, go ahead.
Sorry. Don't you have to go through the buffer to fill the wetland?
That's the county's argument and their attempt to draw the variance procedure into the mitigation sequencing. Mm-hmm. They're not talking about the buffer that we're proposing to protect our project. They're talking about this conceptual illustrative buffer that existed on the wetland that we filled.
So where's the exception in the code for encroaching to a buffer to fill the wetland and fill the buffer as well?
Well, there is no. So as Robin just said, when you fill a wetland, right, the upland that was serving as the buffer, the buffer becomes irrelevant at that point to the mitigation plan. It goes away because you're filling the wetland, right?
Okay.
What the county is saying is that's relevant. That needs to be accounted for, but it doesn't, and this will be explained. So that's the sleight of hand that's going on here that we're trying not to get confused. We are not doing buffer impacts. We have a textbook 50-foot buffer. Some of it's as indirect impacts with wetland serving as buffer. We've gone through the sequencing process, which entitles us to impact modest impacts, less than 7% of the Category 4 wetlands on site. Once we do those impacts, any of those illustrative buffers that were there so we could visualize the building footprint, they go away. They become irrelevant to the process because they are just uplands. And if I was saving this argument, Mr. Examiner, but what is happening here? When you fill that wetland, that illustrative buffer that was there, it just goes away. It's not relevant. Because it's actually not buffering anything, because there's no, with a pristine state, there's no, you know, buffer is a protective area between two things, one protecting the other. Okay. In the pristine state, all it is wetlands. There's no development, so there's no need for a buffer. So it's just there so we can get a sense of where we can build. Once you fill the buffer, that upland that was that illustrative buffer, it just becomes upland again. It serves no purpose. And so what the county is doing is trying to apply the critical areas ordinance to what is now merely non-critical area uplands to require us to go through a critical area variance process where they can recommend denial or drive the project to minimum density. So that's the problem with this, is it's kind of a head spinner, but they are not talking about the buffers that will result in reality after the project is built.
Well, but the reason why it's not a problem is because you violated the code to fill the wetland in the first place.
No.
What in the code allows you to fill a wetland without a critical area variance or some other exception?
Where is that? That's what I'm trying to find. Okay, so the mitigation sequencing section of the code.
Okay, so that's the question I was asking your consultant is, where in the code or what other jurisdiction allows you to fill a wetland just based on mitigation sequencing?
All of them.
Not the Kitsap County judge's order there, but like I said, I've never seen a jurisdiction do that, so I'm just trying to figure that out.
All jurisdictions do that. All jurisdictions go straight to mitigation, avoid, minimize, and then mitigate. If you're
asking me, the wetland is filled, so the jurisdiction allows the wetland to be filled, and then after they apply the code, that's how they do it.
Everybody has mitigation sequencing in their codes. Everybody's
sure, they do, and the mitigation sequencing usually it's applied in the sense that if you're allowed to do a buffer encroachment, then you have to apply mitigation sequencing. That's the way I've seen it applied in the 2,000 cases I've adjudicated. So, like I said, I'm just trying to figure out. You know how this is, and again, I haven't dealt with many projects where the wetlands have been filled, and that could be the distinguishing factor. But you know, like I was asking Mr. Gurney, how is that allowed in the past?
I think this is the distinguishing factor because we all follow the same guidance from ecology. Ecology is the one that gives us writes us our code guidance. Kitsap County adopts their guidance alternatives. You may have read different alternatives in different jurisdictions, but we all follow the same. We beat the drum. We have alternatives and how you look at your buffers, how you mitigate them, what the modifications are, to what extent percentages are, and then how you mitigate them based on your even the ratios that you do. If you're asking me where's the anomaly, I've never, ever heard of doing a variance when you're doing wetland mitigation. That's the anomaly.
No, well, where do you get the authority to fill the wetland in the first place? If you're not allowed to develop within a critical area or its buffer, where's that authority absent of variance or a reasonable use exception or a road exception or something like that to do that?
Well,
where does that come from?
It's the checklist. It's the procedure. It's the checklist we've gone through. Look at your zoning. It's all of those things that we just sat here and listened to, layer after layer after layer, trying to make things fit, looking at safety and health and densities and, everything that we just listened to this morning.
Okay, well, again, the critical area, and I've written several of these ordinances myself, has several exceptions to buffer, to the prohibition to develop within a wetland and its buffer, and I don't know of any that says, okay, if you fill one, you don't have to worry about any of these exceptions. You can do it, and then afterwards you apply your buffer standards. It could be an issue of federal Army Corps, supremacy over local codes and that kind of thing. Like I said, I haven't dealt with wetland filling before, but that's what I'm just trying to nail down is where does that initial authority to encroach in the buffer and encroach in the critical area to fill the wetland come from?
This is kind of an offer of proof.
It doesn't come from the density requirements, certainly not. It could come from federal Army Corps law. That part I don't know. That's where I'm trying to.
I understand. Right. It can be confusing. But the authority in and of itself, with nothing else needed, is Kitsap County Code 19-200-230. That is the mitigation sequencing. Avoid and minimize to the extent practicable, given the purpose of the project. Right. And then you can impact, but you have to mitigate. And they have all the ratios and all the various. That is a self-contained, code that allows for impact of wetlands. Okay,
Yeah, that's the Kitsap County judge's interpretation, which I, like I said, never seen before. And like I said, I think most jurisdictions interpret that as, if you're allowed to do an encroachment, you have to do this mitigation sequencing. But first, you have to be allowed to do the encroachment in the first place. But so what I'm used to. But I'm certainly open to something else. Like I said, I'm just trying to find where that, what the rationale is. And certainly, Ms. Nichols, you're listening, and in the city rebuttal, I'm as a lower decision maker, I think I'm bound by the precedent set by Kitsap County Superior Court. And, page 9 of that judge's order in exhibit, B4, she does say mitigation, you don't need to qualify for a variance or critical areas ordinance to apply that mitigation sequencing. So I'm curious what the county position is on, how distinguishable that is from county regulations and whether I'm bound by precedent. Like I said, Ms. Nichols, that would be just during the county's rebuttal when we're done getting all the public testimony. I wanted to give you a little heads up so I'll give you a chance to look at that. I haven't had a chance to study that decision in detail, but I wanted to know where the county stood on it, before the hearing is closed. So anyway, let's say anything else, Mr. Gorey?
Briefly, just looking at the staff report, I just wanted to down to page 35, I'm sorry, the bottom of page 34 it is. And it just says the findings. I think these are not fair. The proposal is not consistent with a comprehensive plan. Well, Mr. Gurney himself listed, a number of ways in which this project is excellent under land use and other things. And I mentioned the Kingston sub-area plan that will come online in a month. And we hit many, many of those. That's exhibit B49, where that's all laid out. So that's not a fair statement. And then the section number 2 at the top of page 35, the proposal does not comply with all requirements of Kitsap County Code Title 17 well, we've gone through the staff report, and that's demonstrably not true, and does not comply with many of the other applicable provisions of Kitsap County Code and all other applicable regulations. That goes too far. I mean, it just reflects this animus that they don't think, as we've been discussing, that we can use the mitigation sequencing process. As Robin just said, every jurisdiction allows impact of wetlands per that mitigation sequencing alone without a variance. They don't think that's the law, and they're wrong. And we're going to figure that out with the CEPA appeal. I don't jump the horse, but that's what's going on here. That, as I said, that is the lens through which they've looked at this project, that they think it's illegal. And it just colors everything with kind of blanket statements like this. And I do want to point out one other thing. As I said in our very short brief for the Platte PBD, if you're setting aside the environmental issues, which will be figured out, this reads like an approval with conditions. I mean, there's nothing in here that can't be resolved by way of conditions. And I just want to point out Kitsap County Code 21.04.170, which is called General Review Conditions and Requested Information, subsection A, it just says disagreement regarding conditions. In some circumstances, the department and the applicant may disagree on department-recommended conditions. In instances where disagreement on conditions cannot be resolved, the department may approve such conditions, or in the case of a Type 3 or 4 project permit application, which this is, recommend such conditions for approval. So, again, setting aside the environmental, there's nothing that can't be handled by way of an approval with conditions. So I just wanted to make that point. And with that, I will turn it over to my partner.
And I have a question for you, Mr. Hearing Examiner. I'm not fully understanding what your concern is about the buffers. If I may, I'm going to see if what I'm saying is correct. When a project is going to be placed on a piece of property and they're not filling any wetlands, but they can't live with the existing buffers around the wetlands that they found when they arrived, and so then they're looking for buffer averaging, they're looking for a reduction in the buffer, and at that time you're absolutely correct, you have to have a variance. That's the case. Is that what you're worried about?
Well, I'm worried about that you're proposing to fill wetlands without complying with the county's regulations. Like I say, I don't see any exception for filling except through a variance or reasonable use.
No.
I'm just trying to figure out where the authority is to go. And Mr. Burney agreed that can be done. Sometimes he pointed out something in the critical areas variance. I didn't see the language there. I looked it up. So I'm still trying to see where that comes from.
Okay. I just want to be clear on what we need to prove at the appeal. So we need to prove to you that you are being code compliant when you go through the sequencing and you don't need a variance to fill. That's what we need to prove to you. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Don't need a variance.
I will let you know right now that the Department of Ecology and the Army Corps of Engineers have made the flat statement that after filling the wetlands and providing the required buffers around the pre-existing wetlands and the newly created wetlands that replaced the impacted wetlands, they made the flat statement together that the buffers are adequate and legal. So you're going to be seeing that when we get to the heart of this.
Okay. And like I said, I think, my main concern is what gave you the authority to fill in the first place under the county code? That's what I'm trying to find out.
I want to make clear, and it's been made clear, and it's made clear in the brief from the county, and all the brief from the county cites only the two handbooks from the Department of Ecology. One is Wetlands in Washington, and the other is Wetland Mitigation in Washington. And the county attorney included those in their entirety in the brief. So that's what we're dealing with. Are you suggesting that we're going to deviate from what the county's brief arguments are? Are you going to deviate from them or not?
I would just want to know, you know, how wetlands are authorized to be filled, how that's consistent with county code.
It doesn't matter what
the county has in its briefing. I just need to know that. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to find out here.
But I don't want to belabor. So the answer to your question is 19-200-230. That's the answer to your question. That's corroborated by Ecology and the Corps approving everything we've done and acknowledging our right to impact wetlands. That's the answer. And I think what's really telling is that the word variance, as I've said, does not appear in 19-200-230. Does not appear anywhere in there. And in the actual variance section of the CAO, 19-100-135, which is entitled variances, if you read that entire thing, which I've done multiple times, the only place it talks about a variance is in relation to a buffer reduction. And we are not doing that. Our buffers are 50 foot through and through. We're not talking about the buffers that no longer exist around the filled wetlands. I'm talking about the buffers that are protecting our project as built. We're not so
Mr. Gorey, if that 19-200-230 allows you to fill a wetland, then wouldn't it also allow you to build within an existing wetland buffer then for the same reason?
The buffer just ceases to exist, right? As I've been saying.
No, but you're saying that the mitigation sequencing isn't tied to variances or reasonable use exceptions or anything else.
Correct.
You can just apply it independently to fill a wetland.
Correct.
So if you can apply it independently to fill a wetland, why couldn't you also, if you have a buffer with a delineated or wetland with a delineated 200-foot buffer, build within the buffer too?
As David was saying, that's a different section of the code, and that's not what we're doing. Okay, David's going to talk.
Okay. You keep referring to a buffer around a wetland before mm-hmm. development. That's an incorrect statement. There is no buffer around a wetland on these 20 acres, and the only time we're going to need that buffer is if we develop an impact. And so we have to provide the buffer. You're not impacting that pre-existing buffer.
Let's move on to that. Do applicants have anything else you want to say at this point?
No, I mean, just other than, as I started with, you know, if we can get the environmental stuff sorted out, this is a desperately needed, very popular project. Everyone's pulling for it. I do believe we are correct, and I hope we can convince you about this wetland stuff as Judge Forbes ruled in our favor before. It's really the same thing. That sequencing process allows us to do what we're doing. All the wetland experts say so. Ecology says so. Corps of Engineers. The county has nothing to counter that. And that's telling as well. They don't have a wetland specialist who's going to support their position. that's how I view that. And also, if you note, Mr. Hearing Examiner, the December 2023 notice that the county put out where they said, we've looked at everything, including Joanne Bartlett's report with all the impacts, with all the buffer that we created to protect the project. And they said, yep, it looks good. It looks code compliant. We're going to issue a DNS, which also means they didn't see any significant or adverse environmental impact at that time. So everything was good to go. But then something happened. I don't know what happened, but the county, I don't know what, but something flipped for no reason, no basis. Thereafter, after December 2023, our project only got better in an environmental sense. We got rid of those 53 units. We went from 283 to 230. We reduced the impact from 10% to 7%. Okay, we increased the amount of created wetland to compensate for the wetland fill. We added enhancement. We still kept the 13 acres of conservation even. So everything got better, right? Everything. So there was no even more basis in December of 2024 when they issued the termination of significance to just follow through and issue the DNS. They had already gone there. They'd already said, this looks good to us, DNS. So that's another indicia that there's something amiss here. There's some ideology that's running counter to the law. That's what we're fighting against. But as Robin said, every jurisdiction allows wetland impact through the mitigation sequencing, if that's the question. And that's what we're doing.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Gorey. Okay, so I guess we're now on to public comments. And Ms. Jones, you want to start off with people in the meeting room? And like I said, we'll go till 12:50, and then we'll take a break till 2 o'clock at that point. So.
Okay. So they'll be up at the podium. We won't have video for them, but you'll be able to hear them through the microphone. And the first person I have is Warren Reichard, or Reichard, Richard. Sorry. How do you pronounce it? Reichard. Okay. Yes, I was right the first time.
Oh,
yes. Hi.
And Mr. Jones, you'll have to tell me when they get to the podium so I can swear them in.
He's up at the podium.
All right, Mr. Reichard, raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
Okay, my name is Warren Reichard. I go by Bud Reich, but that's no consequence. Interesting, the beginning of the flyer that came out, it says, what's happening in my neighborhood? I'm wondering in 5 years from now, it's going to say, what happened to my neighborhood? We are adjacent to the property that's being developed, and I'm totally stunned that there's not more property owners that can show up. I hope they're online. I don't know that, but we're surprised. I thought the room would be crowded. This seems like I'm an electrical engineer, PE. I've done several of these, if not dozens of these developments, and I would usually on the other side of the fence, but if I liked the project, I'd be giving you my business card. Maybe you'd hire me. But the thing is, I'm probably more of an adversarial at this point. I'm very familiar with the land. I bought the place about 6 years ago. My property is at the end of Shorty Campbell Road. Actually, the property I'm on is the property that Shorty Campbell himself lived on for years, and he owned that whole area. I don't know how many acres, but a lot of acres. It got subdivided, and I ended up with the house and the 2.5 acres where his house is at. And I'm about, I don't know exactly how far, but 100 to 200 yards from the west end of the development. And my concerns, it's a nice development, and to sort of speak, as long as it stayed on Linvog. But as it's approaching westward, and it's taken away what's right now a very pristine, undisturbed land, and you know, lots really beautiful back there. Now we're going to have a big freaking parking lot. And the other thing I'm worried about is like 100 and now it's down to 100 and no, 283 units. That's a, no, sorry, 230 units. That's 138 of low income people. Well, it's not 138 people, actually. It's 138 households. Who knows how many people that translates to. And I have a house in Seattle, the Queen Anne. It's a, Queen Anne. Ooh, Queen Anne. Well, then the cities and all their, and all their intelligence had a, space that was allocated, fenced off for RVs, so they have a place to stay. 12 blocks from my house. Well, all of a sudden now we got people 3 o'clock in the morning mumbling around, graffiti showing up out of nowhere, Queen Anne. So what makes you think that's not going to happen in our neighborhood? You know, that many low-income people, I mean, I'm not going to sit there and pick on low-income. Some people are, good people, humans, they just have a tough fight. But a lot of people, like single family, mother of a single parent, having kids bring their friends in, kids get, do what they do, and we don't need this in our neighborhood. I mean, this is, if this was a smaller development, that'd be great, but it's not. And the other thing I don't see is I don't see any elevations of these buildings. What do they look like? I mean, if you look at it on your site plan, it looks like an army barracks. I mean, there's all these rectangular buildings all in a line, and what's this all going to look like? And I've seen this, I mean, like I said, I've designed these things. And you see them on the flat screen up there, and it's like, well, okay. But if you see them in person, it's a heck of a big impact. It's a very big impact, especially when you live right next door. And I spent my life savings to remodel this house and build my Shangri-La, and here we go. So that's all I got to say. I'm pretty much disappointed and upset. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your testimony. Jones?
The next person, apologies for the pronunciation, please correct me. William Ugolini? Igolini?
No. Oh, okay.
So, not speaking, we'll move on to the next one.
Okay.
Ian Harkins, and he's on his way up.
Okay, let me know when he's up.
And Mr. Harkins is at the podium now.
Okay, Mr. Harkins, just raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great, go ahead.
Great. Good afternoon. My name is Ian Harkins. I'm here on behalf of the Kitsap Building Association. I think the applicants made a compelling case to explain this is exactly the kind of development that we need. It's an affordable housing project in an urban growth area. Urban growth areas are exactly where the county is telling builders to build housing. And not only that, it's an affordable housing project. It should be a dream come true. It's exactly the kind of housing we need. We need low-income housing. We need housing of all income bands. I also think that the hearing examiner should be relying on the expert wetland analysis done by the applicant's wetland consultants that they've hired. They have worked in this county decades. You heard earlier, over 50 jurisdictions. They are as seasoned as it gets, and they are experts in this, and that's whose opinion you should be relying on. And again, in our opinion, we should be supporting all housing, all affordable housing projects, especially in urban growth areas. Where else are these projects going to be built? We have to build a certain amount of units every single year for the next 20 years, to comply with PSRC's Vision 2050. This is a prime example of that. So urging strong support. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Next, we have Ray Holt, and he's making his way up. Mr. Holt is at the podium now.
Okay, Mr. Holt, raise your right hand. Do you swear affirm tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
My name is Ray Holt, and I live in Kingston. And my wife and I are here today in support of the Spring Hill Townhome Project. We have known about it for about 3 years now, and I learned about it because of our involvement in the Kingston Affordable Housing Working Group. So in a sense today, we're representing a larger group of people that have written letters of support about Spring Hill to the county. We had David and Hayes from the development team come to the Kingston Affordable Housing Working Group meeting about 3 years ago now to introduce the project. And immediately afterwards, we're very enthused about it and wrote a letter of support to the commissioners at that time. We've followed the permitting process very closely since then and have written additional letters of support. We affirm that the project has been improved in a number of ways, as the developers mentioned today, and we think it is appropriate location within the UGA and that there is a great need for affordable housing in North Kitsap. In particular, the Kingston Affordable Housing Working Group is a group of that has an email list of about 50 to 60 residents in the Kingston area who are interested in bringing more affordable housing to the Kingston UGA, which is where the affordable housing really needs to be because of the requirement for having sewer and other infrastructure there and not impacting rural areas. But in addition to the 50 to 60 that are on the email list, there's about 15 of us who meet regularly, monthly, and discuss how to bring various affordable housing projects to reality in the Kingston UGA. And we have looked at a lot of parcels in the UGA and found that either the property owner is unwilling to sell or that the parcels aren't large enough. So it's very limited the number of parcels that would be appropriate for a large affordable housing development such as this. The 20-acre parcel that they've identified is appropriate. It's zoned appropriately. It's within the UGA. It's on the edge of the UGA, and I think they've tried to design the location of the actual building not only to avoid the impacts on wetlands as much as possible, but also to be to allow the majority of the property to remain pristine so that it won't affect the neighbors who are in the rural zoning areas just on the opposite side of 272nd and further along Shorty Campbell. So I think they've tried to address that. But I want to talk about, really, from the Kingston Affordable Housing Working Group's perspective, the need for affordable housing. About 2 years ago, the Public Health District for Kitsap County did a survey of households to try to determine what the housing costs were. And the result of that survey that we received a copy of at the Affordable Housing Working Group indicated that more than 20% of the households in North Kitsap are considered what's called cost burdened in their housing costs. And what that means is that those people are spending more than 33% of their gross monthly income on housing costs, which would be rent if they're renting, or mortgage, utilities, and possibly some other things like insurance or the interest on a mortgage. So that needs to be at 33% or less. And if it's more than that, people are cost burdened because it's probably going to affect other expenses that they have, where it's difficult for them to buy groceries or to get medical care. So it's an important number. And one of my other responsibilities in the Kingston area, I serve on the board of the SureNet Food Bank. And in fact, I'm the president this year. And I see firsthand the number of clients who come in because they can't afford their groceries. They're coming to the food bank, and it's just been increasing because of rents going up and people not being able to afford their housing. So they're having to supplement their purchasing of groceries with assistance from the food bank, which is a wonderful thing. I'm glad that we're there. But it makes me aware of how there is this great need in North Kitsap for affordable housing. So here we have an affordable housing project that is exciting, not just because it will meet the need of some of these 20% of households that we're talking about, but because it will also lead to home ownership for those folks who qualify, who are income qualified. Not just renting. I mean, isn't that the American dream? Is that we would have a home of our own and be able to build equity and to get out of a cycle of poverty that maybe has lasted for generations because of the opportunity to enter into a home ownership. So I think this is a wonderful project that is deserving of support. And I would ask also that there be some consideration to, well, what happens to that parcel if this application is denied? You know, according to what the DCD said, it should be 66 units on that parcel. If that's the case, what is going to be built there? It's going to be high-end, expensive homes, because developers are not going to be able to do affordable housing projects for the cost to make it financially feasible for them. So we already have so many developers in this county who focus on big homes, on big properties to make as much money as possible because they're not interested in affordable housing. I think it's important to have some place where affordable housing can be built. And this project, I believe, meets that need. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Ms. Jones?
Are there any others?
Okay. Yeah. I think we can hear from one or two more people before we take our lunch break. So let's see, I guess first on the attendee virtual list is just iPhone.
All right, I'll pull him over to speak.
Okay. All right. And,
hello?
Hi there. So, ma'am, could you tell us your name for the record, how to spell it, and then I'll swear you in.
Oh, my name is Glenda, G-L-E-N-D-A, Jenkins, J-E-N-K-I-N-S.
Okay, Ms. Jenkins, I'll swear you in first. You can raise your right hand. Do you swear firm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
Okay, great. Go ahead.
You have a very important job deciding about the approval of the Spring Hill Revised Application versus protection of a critical natural resource that benefits everyone and every creature living in Kingston now and in the future. There will be lasting impacts and consequences for those who currently reside in the Kingston community, especially those who presently live on Lindbaugh Road, and to future residents who may move here. Spring Hill's stated purpose is to satisfy the need and mandate to, quote, make a meaningful, not de minimis, contribution to the inventory of for-sale low-income housing in Kitsap County to address the housing crisis throughout our state. As Governor Inslee has said, quote, that when it comes to affordable housing, we need to go big so people could go home. There is no arguing the crisis for affordable housing is real. Likewise, the climate crisis is real. The Spring Hill proposal has the potential to provide for housing, but it raises questions and concerns. The wetlands, number one, the wetlands it will be built on, the density and number of units, and the impact on Kingston infrastructure and character of this community. The two parcels are on part of wetlands. I personally witnessed and filmed water seeming to percolate up and flow from the ground into the storm drain on Northeast Kingston Meadows Circle when I've taken walks. Also standing water on the shoulder of the road. I have videos available that I can give you links to. The proximity to Kingston Creek, which seems to emanate from within the wetlands buffer shared by Kingston Meadows and the Maples. There's also a YouTube video of that. I've walked down Linvog coming out of Kingston Meadows and seen what appears to be water seeping up through cracks in the asphalt on Linvog Road and on Northeast Rodston Lane within the Maples development. I have photos available too. There are compelling reasons to protect wetlands for the benefit of the entire planet. I sent in a letter and I've attached links to this. Healthy, functioning wetlands can help reduce mosquito populations. Again, you refer to the eco-links that I can provide. Wetlands play an important role in tackling climate change due to their high carbon sequestration rate. And there is a link, a wetland carbon sink link. Wetlands are a natural ecosystem that is home to wildlife and especially frogs, a species that is declining due to human-caused habitat destruction and climate change. And there is a toads and frogs link available. I have questions and concerns for the families who would purchase and dwell in any of the 230 high-density units. I've lived in crowded situations, and it can create tensions between neighbors. Families and children need adequate space for movement and play. But I don't, listening now, having been listening to the hearing, are they suggesting that they're going to get to play in critical wetlands? I'm not certain about that. If you drive up Linvog Road, there are not continuous sidewalks for anyone to walk down to the corner of Linvog and the highway. There's, in front of the Maples, we have a graveled pathway, and then it stops and ends, and there's no sidewalk either side of the street. And then there is sidewalk that begins where the old lumber yard used to be. Will families experience noise pollution from the road and from having neighbors on either side so close? Will the removal of trees and the reduction of wetlands contribute to poor air quality, increases in temperature, and changes to weather patterns? If there were wildfires, imagine the congestion of cars attempting to flee. If the big one, the big earthquake that we have been told to prepare for were to happen, would those homes stand up? Would the ground hold for them? I have concerns about the existing infrastructure and character of the community of Kingston. One other point I forgot. I have seen in Kingston where there are apartments and not adequate parking that there are a lot of cars that end up parking on the street. Also, we have a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit. The county has put in one of those digital readers that tells you how fast you're going. But you know what? It doesn't really work. people speed up and down this road at all hours of the day and night. So I would think there would be a need for speed bumps. We don't have a police department, and according to the website, our sheriff's office is closed until further notice. I was wanting to find statistics about the closest hospital that's in Silverdale, because I've been told it has the highest number of emergency admissions in the state. But I went to the Washington State Department of Health website, and there's a new notice that says, please note that some links to federal government websites may be broken due to new presidential executive orders. Will the four fire departments in Kingston have adequate engines, firefighters, and emergency medical technicians to respond to rapid growth? Are the Kingston schools prepared to accept large increases to the student body? And to talk about the character here, I moved here 6 years ago, and I was just so thrilled about the this community and the beautiful community center that was built with a Boys and Girls Club, a park, a library, a garden, and housing for seniors. A lovely facility. And I was welcomed there, a total brand new unknown person into the community. I attended many of the offerings there at the Village Green. And right away, I moved here in June, and neighbors on Linvog Road volunteered to clean up someone else's yard because she was injured. This was recorded on KOMO. And so it's a welcoming community. It's a caring community. Kingston cares about people. They offer free meals at the Village Green. They offer sleeping for shelters for homeless people when the weather is severe, and showers. And so it is a wonderfully caring community. And I believe that a lot of people here would welcome families who can't otherwise afford to purchase a home. But like, you know, like a patient and a doctor that collaborates on the risks and benefits of surgery, this application requires a review of the risks to our natural resources and for the health of our planet and for the community of Kingston. The optimal quality of life for our current and future residents and wildlife of Kingston hangs in the balance. In the immortal words of Joni Mitchell, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? Paved paradise, and they put in a parking lot. I humbly ask that you not decide until a review is completed on the wetlands that exist on the two parcels Spring Hill will permanently alter or destroy. And you have my highest regards for the weight of your decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jenkins. All right, so like I said, we'll take a break until 2 o'clock. And I realize, thank you all for your patience. It's been a long haul just to be heard. Some of you may not want to have to sit through this afternoon. So what I'm going to do is, if you you don't want to have to sit through this afternoon to make your comments, go ahead and submit your comments in writing to Ms. Jones. I'll take those comments until 5 p.m. tomorrow. And, of course, the applicant staff will have an opportunity to respond in writing to those comments as well. But for those of you who think you've sat through enough, and I don't blame you for that, you know, feel free to just submit something in writing by 5 tomorrow. We'll take that in lieu. So with that, we'll see you at 2 o'clock.
And I'm going to be ending the webinar, so if you are rejoining online, just know that you'll have to redo that. So just as a heads up.
And Ms. Jones, could you advise for the pre-hearing conference? I'll be on at 1:05 just because I need a little time to read documents for that. So, okay, we'll see you then.
Recording stopped.